This is The Listening Post. It's Capital Radio 101.7 FM and Capital Digital here in Perth, Western Australia. And as you know, tonight's guest is Arthur Leggett. Now, I've said a few words about Arthur, but I'm going to ask him straight off if he remembers something of his childhood, because unfortunately he wasn't born here in Western Australia. He was born in New South Wales. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, indeed. I was actually born in Manly, a suburb of Sydney, but quite early after the First War, we moved out to Moree in the northeast corner of New South Wales because my father had come home from the First War, an invalid, and he was looking for dry air to help his lungs get along. But the circumstances in Moree were a bit rugged at the time, and we moved down to Manly again, where he took up a shop in Manly. He was a boot and shoe repairer, by the way, quite a good one. I've seen him start with a piece of leather and finish up with a pair of boots. He was that capable. But unfortunately, his health, of course, was going down all the time. He had been caught in a gas attack. Now, in the early days, back in 1910, he migrated out here with some sisters of his who lived in Western Australia. And my mother decided that we should come back to WA so that he could be with his sisters and so on. And that's how I came back to Western Australia.
Do you remember it, Western Australia, as it was back then?
Oh, yes, indeed.
Please tell me.
Well, it was a good bush town. And if you wanted to meet anybody, you just stood on the corner of Hay Street and Barrack Street, and they'd go past. You're bound to see them there. From Inglewood out was scrub, and the 18 tram line finished at Grand Prom, and that was as far out as the city went.
So where were you living?
We lived around in quite a few places, but during my teenage years, we were living in First Avenue over near the railway station, and that was just a nice area out of Perth at the time.
Do you think that your dad's First World War experience, did he talk anything about that to you? Did you just learn it by osmosis?
Well, we got bits and pieces. I got it mainly from my mother because I was growing up and I thought, this is not like a normal family. We're not living like statics. And then she told me the story, of course, and I've got quite a lot of it from Dad's sisters. When I was a teenager, I started asking questions, and it gradually got to know it all.
So how would you describe your father then?
He was disillusioned. Put it that, this is the impression that I got. He was all the time trying to create a business to look after his wife and his kids, and all the time he was slowly dying. Mm. And of course it was a frustrating effort. Mm. And gradually he had to give up boot and shoe making, and he got a job as a caretaker and for Mount Lawley RSL at one stage when they were living in Riley's Hall in Grosvenor Road, Mount Lawley. And I was out of work, and I got a job up on the goldfields at Laverton.
What age were you at this point?
About 16, yeah. And I was working on a dairy. I had put in about, best part of a year on a farm, so I knew how to milk a cow, and I was up there working on a dairy. And Dad was the orderly in the hospital. But unfortunately, he got worse, and the doctor at the hospital sent him back down to the Repat Hospital in Perth. And he was in and out of that from there onwards.
So your later memories of your father was of a very sick man?
Yes, indeed. Although, again, if we're going to leapfrog a bit, I was in a prisoner of war camp when he passed away, so although he was, really going downhill, I wasn't there to be with him.
Okay, let's go then. So at 16, you're doing this job. Was the attraction for military service in your mind at all at that point, or far from it?
Oh, yes. Mum and Dad came out from England about 1910, and our family was awfully British. I mean, we had photos of St. Paul's Cathedral and houses of Parliament all around the place at home. And, if it wasn't British, it was no good. And I had the spirit of the British Empire in my blood. And when the 16th Battalion Cameron Highlanders was formed, I'm one of the originals. I was there.
So can you recall that?
Oh, yes. Well, that's quite an episode. I was in the 16th Battalion mainly because they had horse transport and there was horses to ride. I put in 3 years there, quite an enjoyable time. I've worn a kilt and I understand I'm the only original left around the place. The current 16th Battalion has done some nice things for me, invited me out to numerous functions.
So they should.
Yeah, but getting back to your original question, when the war broke out, I was down Nicholson Road, Subiaco Drill Hall to enlist straight away. They had the drill hall set up in little cubicles and they had some old soldiers from the First World who were out of work. They were doing the elementary physical part, like your chest expansion when you got flat feet and how tall you were. And from the Cameron Highlanders, several officers had immediately joined the 2nd 11th Battalion. And one of them was a certain Major Sandover, an awfully British chap. And anyway, I'm the chappie in the cubicle measuring me up. He said, "Oh, well, you can't join." I said, "Why not?" Well, he said, "You've got to be 5'4". You're only 5'3½". Oh, now, come on, mate. Look, I've been 3 years in the militia. No, he said, "Look, I can't go outside the border." While we're arguing, Major Sandover's strolling through, seeing his hair. "Oh, hello, Leggett. Going to join us, are you?" And the old soldier says, "I'm afraid he's not, sir. He's only 5'3½". And, "Oh, rubbish. We measured him years ago. He's 5'4". Bung him through, old chap." And I was bunged through. And a couple of years later, when I'm shoveling coal in a Polish coal mine as a prisoner of war, I thought, if that Major Sandover had just shut his mouth for a few minutes. But that's how life is.
I like that. Now, while I have time to digest that, Arthur, I think we do need some music. Capital Radio with the Listening Post. I'm Tony Haas and we're talking tonight with Arthur Leggett. Now, Arthur, I want to move us on now, if you would. I think chronologically your next stint army-wise is North Africa. Would that be correct?
That would be correct, yes. We of course, put in quite a long time in Palestine training for desert warfare before moving up into North Africa.
So how did that progress? The North Africa campaign.
Oh, well, we were in the original battles of Badia, Tobruk, but we were part of a division, our battalion, and I don't think we played prominent parts in Badia or the original capture of Tobruk. There was an episode there, though, where we crept up quietly at night. I was a member of the signal platoon. And we dug slit trenches and crawled around and set up signal stations, run out a bit of cable and so on. And the corporal, who had a bit more military knowledge than me, says, "There's going to be a big barrage in the morning and I want to see it." And you wake me up, right? So in the morning I crept over and woke up Corporal Lou Gracie. "It's getting close to the time." Right, and he crawls over to my trench and, "Oh, about 5 o'clock, all hell breaks loose. There's guns going off, you can hear them and flashing, but we couldn't see a damn thing." And so we turned around and we looked towards the front, and we were about 15 kilometres behind the artillery lines, and we'd been crawling around whispering to each other all night. And that day we moved forward. Honest, I had a signal exchange, I had flags, I had a bit of cable, and it looked like a tin hat, a heap of signalling gear and 2 feet moving forward. They could have hit me with an anti-tank rifle and it would have gone off.
But if you were a six-footer, you would have been a bigger target.
Oh, well, they would have put more material on me to carry, I'm sure. At Derna, we were involved in it. We were the advance battalion there, and we lost a few men getting across the aerodrome. And I was attached to D Company under Captain Wood. We got down the escarpment onto the flat ground and we could see Derna, and we spread out and we're advancing towards it, and suddenly we were caught in an artillery barrage that just crept along towards us and got amongst us and moved back and then came through us again. And I know the company sergeant major, he was hit in the head, and I never saw him again till I was back in civilian life, and he had a silver plate in his head. And we lost a couple of men there, but it started to rain. We couldn't do any good, and we managed to get a line through to the captain of the company, and he had a yarn with the colonel, and we pulled back out of there and got up out of the escarpment where we camped until the Derna fell, and we moved into Derna and occupied that.
Arthur, it might be a bit of a curly one for you, but with those experiences, what stayed with you? The horror, or you mentioned humour to me, other than when we were broadcasting. So what sticks in your mind at this point in time of that period?
Well, during the Battle of Tobruk, when we moved forward, we were a support battalion. I came across my first dead men. That shook me because they were only young people like me. And this was members of the Italian army. That shook me a bit. It rained, of course, it rained. After the capitulation of Benghazi, well, we had them all rounded up in a big flat area and we were on guard duty around them, and it rained like hell and they're all bunched together standing up. They can't sit down because of the mud or anything, and it was a pretty miserable sort of a time then. There are other horrendous parts. It came on later on in my military history, but we'll probably cover that later.
Okay, yes, indeed. Just one last question. The Italian soldier, how did you rate him?
Oh, well, I can give you an example. We were, I'm not sure, I think it was outside Tobruk or Derna, an Italian dispatch rider came boring across the battlefield, and he got too close to our battalion, and one of our officers picked up a pick handle and brought him down, and he got up and abused us and real good Australian bullock drivers. Like, he was a young fellow of Italian background who lived just out of Perth at the time, and he was the son of a market gardener. He'd gone home to meet his grandparents. Italians had put him in the army, and there he was in North Africa. When he heard there was West Australians over there, he said, I'm going home. I suppose the poor cow finished up spending the war in a POW camp in Australia, but that's one of those things.
Indeed, one of those things. We've got more of one of those things from you in a moment, Arthur. I want to talk about Greece and Crete and so on, and those sorts of things, but music right now. You're listening to The Listening Post. We're talking with Arthur Leggett, and I'm Tony Howes. Now, Arthur, we've left you, before the music, we left you behind in North Africa and talking about the Italian campaigns and things. Now, can we move on, please, to Greece and to Crete? Tell me, how What was the period of time between the North Africa and then into Greece?
From North Africa, we were just moved back, re-equipped mainly with clothing because we'd been living in the same clothes for 3 months, and put on troop ships and just up into Greece. It was as quick as that. Because the Germans had invaded Greece and we were still in North Africa at the time, and so we.
Were you given much information about what had happened as far as the Germans into Greece?
Well, we knew they had entered Greece, but we weren't given very much. I mean, you're not given much when you got your head down, doing your best, and so. I can't say we were given a detailed account of it, no.
What happened in Greece for you?
Well, for me, the whole battalion went right up into the border of Yugoslavia. And being a signal, we laid out, well, the battalion took up its positions and we laid out the contacts. And then we're told to fold them all up again because they were moving back. And we moved all the way back to Brailos Pass. We again, the battalion companies took up their position and we laid out telephone lines to them. I'm on the telephone exchange back at battalion headquarters and we were waiting the attack or the penetration of the German forces at Brailos, and we had a party line, put it that way, on the telephone, so that there was two companies moved up on the one phone and then a single line back to battalion headquarters. Okay, the Germans attacked with mortars. They broke the line, the two signallers down in the company. One of them, Ray Kennedy, he crawled out and mended the wire and got it all working again. And then it got broken again. He gets out and he ties it up. He told me later, he said, I just tied it up. I didn't put the insulation tape around. I thought the corporal won't come along to check it out anyway. And Ray got the military medal for that action because it kept the two companies and the commander and the battalion commander in touch with each other. Incidentally, Colonel Louch had been withdrawn because of ill health. He'd broken down, and Major Sandover was in charge of the battalion from there onwards. And we fought a battle there until it got too dark to see or do anything, and the Germans looked like surrounding us anyway, and we withdrew then back down to the coast, where we were evacuated out of Greece and taken direct across to Crete.
So, you're in Crete. What happened there?
Well, we're a raggle-taggle mob because we'd been right up the front. We'd been bombed and hackled and attacked under constant attack for all about 11 days, I suppose. And the gear that you had on your back when you climbed up the scrambling nets is what you had to fight the next war with. Mm. And I had a couple of telephones, I remember that bit, but when we got to Crete, we'd been bombed all the way to Crete, and we managed to get there, but there was one, the Costa Rica, I think, yes, she was not straddled, but had a stick of bombs down the side. It was obviously going down. I got this from one of the boys after the Navy ship come up after, and there's this conversation. The bombers are gone. Everything's quiet. And, hello, Costa Rica, what's the trouble? And there's a quiet Australian voice says, we've run out of petrol, you silly mask. Anyway, but the British, he said, I'm afraid we'll have to abandon ship. Oh, righto, abandon ship. And they did. They never lost a man.
I mean, phlegmatism, I think it's called.
Oh, it's what built the empire, old boy. And
so Crete for you, your memories.
Well, we got ashore and we just camped in the scrub overnight, and we were then moved up to Retimo. Now, adjacent, well, a few miles out of Retimo, there was an airstrip. On one side of the airstrip was the ocean. On the other side was terraced hills where they grew olive trees. And so we were in the olive trees overlooking this airstrip, and our task, we knew there were going to be paratroopers, so our task was to keep this airstrip clear, because obviously they would then, if they had have taken that airstrip, they'd taken attacked the main battle from the rear. So that's how we were, and we lived that way for a month, and you've never seen such a raggle-taggle look in all your life as what we were. Some had shorts and socks, and some had boots, and some had... Well, I know my mate, he had the colonel's pants, because the other ones have got ripped to hell, and the colonel said, oh, take these. And the... And eventually the paratroop, well, we were bombed again and machine gunned for a month, put it that way. We dug in, we had slit trenches, and eventually they came. And, well, you've seen it all on pictures, and they just bailed out in their hundreds. And so my meagre knowledge, which is, I wouldn't say is accurate, but they dropped about 2,000 paratroopers there during the course of the afternoon, and by 9 o'clock that night, there was just about 500 of them left in a village nearby, which they were terrific soldiers. They immediately fortified it and they hung on there. Well, we tried for a week to get them out of it, but no, we lost men, quite a few men, along, when I say we, the battalion lost quite a few men. And eventually the island just capitulated down the other end. We'd won our section more or less, but and we had no option. So I think again it was Major Sandover who said the island's capitulated. It's every man for himself. And he said, I'm off over the mountains. So a group of us got to the mountains behind Retimo, but there was an old Greco there, dressed in the ancient type, and he had a shotgun and a ball about 3 inches, and he showed us how to get over the mountain down the other side, and there were several hundred men there. We thought a submarine might come in and pick us up, but it didn't happen that way, and eventually a German officer with a interpreter strolled in amongst us and said, we've got mortars up there, machine guns there. Now, if you want fight, you can have it, but we suggest you just come and be prisoners of war. That was the end of the war, as far as that side of it went.
I think that means we're going to have some music now again, Arthur, and because I want to ask you about being a prisoner of war after we come back. We're speaking with Arthur Leggett tonight on The Listening Post on Capital Radio, and we've just, before the music, we've just allowed him to be captured. So he becomes a prisoner of war. But tell me the initial sort of feeling when this German officer strolls in and says, you know, put your hands up. What was your immediate reaction? Do you recall?
Oh, yes. He didn't actually say, put your hands up. He just invited us to come and be prisoners of war. And it wasn't until that night when we were all sleeping in a paddock with guards surrounding us that I just felt abandoned. I mean, there was the British Empire couldn't help me. Australia couldn't help me. My mum and dad couldn't do anything. And there I was, a prisoner. And I really felt abandoned, but that fortunately passed away in due course, but that was the original.
That was the initial feeling.
That's the initial feeling.
All right, from that position, that and the way of the feeling, how did the change in your attitude come about? With physical changes, probably.
Well, I can tell you we went right down to the very bottom. They kept us in the civilian jail for a while. Then they put us in one of those trains, which you've seen on the pictures. We were in one of these carriages 6 days and six nights.
So this was on the Italian mainland, where were you?
We were on Crete, and they put us in little boats, which had been coal hulks, I think, because we were just shoved down below the decks and taken right up into Salonika. And from there, Well, we were kept there for a month and we were systematically starved and treated like not the best. Your life wasn't worth tuppence. Although Germany was a signatory to the International Red Cross, until you got into Germany, you were not registered. So there was that blank space where you didn't exist. Yeah, you didn't exist. When we lost several fellows that were shot for no reason at all. And we basically crammed into one of these trains and locked in there for 6 days and six nights. And we had men who had dysentery and diarrhea and all sorts of sickness. And I'd reached a stage where I just couldn't stand up if I wanted to. I had to crawl across the floor to the wall and climb up the wall and hang on until my head cleared and then I could see where I was going.
Did they feed you at all?
Well, very little. We had a loaf of bread and a tin of bully beef and we were told that's your ration for 6 days and six nights. Well, it got a bit grim by the time, because we had been living on nothing for a month prior to that. Mm. Anyway, we got to Germany and we were in a big camp, which was Stalag 7A at Moosburg. And there we were de-loused. We were showered, cleaned up and given clean clothing. And our uniforms, such as they were, was part of every unit or every nation that had been conquered by Germany. I know I had a pair of wooden clogs, I had a pair of Polish jodhpur-type pants and a French coat and a French hat, and that's just how we were dressed.
Quite different from your Cameron Highlanders.
Yes, they were a bit, yeah. But after a while, we were re-equipped entirely with British Army gear, boots, socks, underclothes, and everything but weaponry, put it that way. Mm-hmm. And this, thankfully, came through the International Red Cross and kept us going. And also, we were issued with a food parcel through the International Red Cross again, once a fortnight. So you mucked in with your mate, you use his parcel 1 week, yours the other. And we were sent into Munich into smaller camps, about 500 men in a camp, and from those camps you went out to work parties, to what particular work. Well, I was fortunate. There was 20 of us were allocated to the town asphalt works. And the Germans there, oh, welcome to Germany, shook your hand and looked after you. They just treated you as an equal from there onwards.
Could you describe that in a little more detail, Arthur? The difference between the way you were treated initially and then, shall we say, in the official prisoner of war area, quite different.
Oh, yes, there was a difference in how we were treated. Originally, especially in that camp in Salonika, it seemed to me that his frontline troops were real soldiers. Okay, we lost, so that's bad luck, and they treated you quite leniently. You moved back, and they especially trained people to guard prisoners, and your war wasn't worth tuppence there. It was just worth nothing. The train trip into Germany can only be described as horrendous, and the treatment we had, there was men, as I said, who had, well, dysentery. There was a small window in the carriage. Some fellas had it jammed in. They'd lend it to this bloke, and then you try and empty it out the window, and some of it would blow over the guard sitting in a box at the end of the carriage. And then the next stop, the doors open, you're all pushed up one end, and they belted and bashed you individually and threw you up the other end. And you couldn't do much about it.
And this was quite different to the, inverted commas, official POW camp.
Yes. Oh, yes. Yes. Oh, yes. Once we got there, the guards were, well, some had been in the first war. Some had been in the present war and were wounded. They were all soldiers. Yeah. But we were in Munich for about 18 months, and then we were sent across up into Poland to work in the coal mines. And life was a bit different then. You worked for a fortnight and you had a day off to clean up your gear and so on, clean yourself up too and your clothing. And so that was good, in as much as we could have a game of soccer on the weekends, things of that nature. But life was a bit strict there because you're in Poland and, well, you were in the enemy territory, really, and they were pretty hard on you there. But in late 1944, it was snow, winter snow everywhere, and we could hear thunder at night, and it gradually dawned on us that in a snowstorm you don't get thunder, it must be guns. And apparently the Russians were advancing in our direction, not just our little camp, but
the whole area.
Whole area. Okay, so the old Fritz said, well, tomorrow you're moving out of the camp, only what you can carry on your back. There's no transport, whatever you got. So we fashioned up sledges and things out of the furniture in the camp and packed our bits of gear on it and so that we could pull it. Next day we marched out these gates. We marched 800 kilometres across Europe in the worst winter in 50 years. And I can tell you, she was rugged. And we camped in cow sheds, barns, anywhere where you could get out of the cold snow. The snow would adhere to your boots. The warmth of your boots would melt it. Your socks and everything would get wringing wet. You'd wring your socks out at the end of the day, tucked them underneath you in the straw. If you had straw underneath, you'd try and keep them warm. And next morning, you'd have an eighth of an inch of ice inside your boot to start a day's...
I'm laughing, but I shouldn't be laughing.
Well, we laugh at it now. So, yeah, so... And we just marched right across through the Czechoslovakian Alps, back down into Bavaria, where we were liberated by the General Patton 7th Armoured Corps.
Before we get you out of your prisoner of war camp, a little birdie told me you were involved with entertaining inside the prison. Now, is that a truth, Arthur, or is that a...
No, it's a truth. We, of course, within the camp, we formed an entertainment committee to keep the morale of the boys up, and I don't know how yet, but I was the president of this mob. And
you don't surprise me, Arthur.
It paid off quite well, as a matter of fact. Oh, we put on some good shows, I can tell you. But we used to charge the boys 5 marks to see our show, because we found out with this, they used to pay us in paper money, which was useless. And we found out that we could negotiate with the administration and hire costumes from the village or from the local town. But the firm that printed this paper money got bombed out, and they had to pay us in real money. So when we commenced this march, I had a roll of German money, 4 inches in diameter at least, and the secretary, who was English, he said, you know, we should give this back to the boys. And I said, no, look, we'll hang on to it, and we'll buy stuff along the way. Yeah. Well, there was nothing along the way except frozen bodies and what have you in the snow. And so, okay, and I'm liberated. I got this roll of German money. We're flown up to Brussels, and we landed there on VE night. And, the town was in an uproar celebration. The British Grenadier Guards bands was marching around the square. There were thousands of people in. We had to leave. We're in groups of 20. There again, I'm in charge of 20 men, not because I had authority, but because I'd found a pencil and paper that could write names on, and that was all the army wanted. But we're told if there's one man missing next morning, the rest will wait until they find him. Anyway, we go into the town, and I get separated from me mate. So I climb up a post, telephone post, to see if I could spot him. No, I couldn't, but there's 3 young ladies coming along in this crowd, and I give them a wave, and they give me a wave, and they say, come and join us. Well, 3-1, you can't fight that. So I got down, and we marched around, but I just marched 800 kilometres, and I said, there must be somewhere we can get a drink. And no, don't think so. Well, let's try that cafe. Well, we go over there, and I had changed this German money into Belgian money. So the chap said, now look, there's no room anywhere. Anyway, now listen, mate, now comes this roll of money. Back in Australia, I got a cattle station bigger than Belgium itself. Now, it's drinks for everybody because we... And so that's what happened to some of that money. When I got to England, I changed it into English money and I bought an old motorbike, which I rode all over southern England while I managed to stay there. But that's another part of when we arrived in England. We were liberated at Regensburg Airport, aerodrome. We were in groups of 20, as I say, and in come a flock of Dakota aircraft and put us all in there, and I had this list of names on nice sheets of paper that I'd pinched in an office somewhere, and the American at the door of the aircraft said, we don't want paper, we want men, get in, fellas, and he gave us a stick of chewing gum each. But we stayed overnight in Brussels, as I said. Next day, we're taken out to the airport, and at the end of this airstrip, we'd never seen an airstrip before, but there's one there, and at the end of it was a British Army issue table, a British Army issue form. There was a Pommy corporal sitting there, and at the end of this table was 6'2" of Sandhurst tradition. He shone, he was perfect, his mow was trimmed right, and his hat was right. Well, I wound up, hold out the ship's piece of paper, yes. List of names. Yes. And I said, what's wrong with this bloke? And finally the penny dropped. You know, Mr. Name, sir. Oh, thank you. And he takes his papers out with something dirty that had blown across the draft. Give it to the corporal at the table. Group 20, corporal. Group 20, sir. That plane over there. Well, that plane over there was an Avro Lancaster manned by Australians. And they made us welcome. I'm last on. They shut the door. And most of the men are sitting up forward over the wing area, and I'm just under the turret gun, and I'm looking at the tail. We get out the end of the airstrip, give her the gun, and the tail lifts, and it moves there and moves there. And I thought, I don't like the look of this. And bang, what had happened? The wheel had come off. The pilot just wound the other wheel up and sat it down, and there we were, banging and crashing along. And I'm just hanging on the side of the plane. I thought, 4 years in a prison camp, and I'm not going to get out of this one. Anyway, she pulled up, and the pilot's chucking blokes out up the front, and get out as quick as you can, boys. Oh, big bronze Anzac, she's right, skipper. But as he said this, the rear gunner had got out, opened the door, and there we were sitting in a pool of petrol that went from the wingtips of the tail plane and the four motors were smoking away. We got out of there, put in a truck, taken back to the end of the airstrip where there's one table, one form, one Pommy corporal in this office, but I'll wake up to him. One list of names, sir. Thank you. Group 20 corporal. Sir, they've gone. And he said to me, you've gone. I said, yeah, but look, see that smoke at the end of the airstrip? We come out of that. Oh, you can't do that, he says. What about my books? Well, I'd been 4 years in a prison camp defying authority, and I told him what to do with the books. And we all went back to the hangars where we were having a nice afternoon drinking beer with the Australian Air Force. In comes a bloke with a roll, rings up his arm, and he said, what are you blacks doing here anyway? And I told him, he said, I'll get you out of here. Not that we don't like your company. He said, I'm trying to preserve our beer. And anyway, we were sent off to England.
Arthur, I reckon your POW experience was 5 times as dangerous as your actual war experience.
I'm an old man. You remember the funny things. You don't remember your mates getting shot or things like that. You don't remember the horror of battles. And you certainly don't carry any animosity with you anymore. And so you just talk about the funny things.
To finish, Arthur, I just want to say, how did you find adjusting to life, ordinary civilian life, once you returned to Australia?
Well, personally, I didn't know it then, but I know it now. I had quite a battle. I served my time after the war as a boilermaker welder, but I found out I was allergic to work, so I went back to night school and got a job finished up in an office, doing office work. But I had about five jobs in 5 years, and when I look back, I don't know how my wife stuck to me. I mean, I bought a quarter acre block, and she came out from England to marry me. We married here in Australia. Now, she left her home, her homeland, and all those things, a mum, dad, father, came all the way out to Australia to marry a bloke she'd only known a few months. And I got a quarter acre block. I built a 10 by 20 shed on it, and we lived in there for 2 years. And I often think when I look back, how she ever stuck to me, I'll never know. Because there we were, straight from dear old England into a shed in a bloody paddock. But she loved me, I guess.
When I grow too old to dream, I'll have you too.
And a very, very big thank you to Arthur Leggett for being with us tonight in the Listening Post. There's lots more stories from Arthur, and I'm sure we'll hear more from him in the future. Thanks indeed, Arthur.